Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today and for next week, our special guest is Bill Shipp. Bill has been investing in real estate in Riverside for many years, and he's actually probably Riverside's best kept secret, one of the largest investors, and probably not as many people know him as should. Bill, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Bruce, for inviting me here.
You bet. How long ago did you get into buying real estate?
Well, I started flipping full time in '86.
Okay.
I actually did my first flipper when I was 18 years old.
Really?
Yeah, I bought a lot in Quail Valley, right outside of Canyon Lake.
Did it perk?
I think it's still a lot.
Okay, then that was a valid question. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and what gave you the idea as an 18-year-old to go do that?
Actually, I had a family member that had bought it and couldn't afford it, the little probably $40 or $50 a month payments, and asked me if I would take it over, and I said, sure.
Okay.
So I bought it with no money for $2,600, and I sold it for a couple years later for like $6,000.
Okay.
So that was my first experience. I think I made like $3,000.
All right. Well, I'm going to go backwards then, because not too many people get asked at 18-year-old to buy anything. So were you an entrepreneurial type before that?
I think so. Probably by 18, I probably already had like 20 jobs. I switched around a lot because I wanted to learn a little bit of everything.
Okay.
And I guess my family told me when I was a little kid, I always said, I want to buy a house, because we never owned a house.
Really?
Yeah, I was an Air Force brat, and okay. I moved around, quite a bit. Like junior high, I probably went to 5 junior highs in a 2-year period.
So did you have, let's say, the lawn route, or did you have, were you the guy that sold the candy by the piece or something?
No, not really. I could never be entrepreneurial because I was never there long enough.
Okay.
And that's why I always wanted to buy a house, because our family never owned one.
All right.
And I just got tired of moving all the time.
Okay, so you sold the lot, and there was really no blueprint for you other than that experience. So you said you got into it full-time. How long did you do it part-time, and what else did you do before that?
Well, prior to '86, I was in the corporate world, and a really good friend of mine was a real estate investor in Long Beach, Compton, and Linwood area. And he says, you know, because I was always complaining about the corporate world, and he says, why don't you start doing real estate? And I says, well, I really don't know anything about it. And he says, why don't you take a week's vacation and drive around with me, and I'll show you what I do. So I took a week's vacation, and I had to be at his house at 6 o'clock every morning. If I was like a minute late, he would tell me the training was over.
Okay.
He'd drive me around in his fancy Rolls Royce and show me houses, and I thought, this is pretty cool. And he, you know, he said, do you think you'll ever be able to have one of these, you know, the car that I was driving in, by working in the corporate world? And I said, probably not. And he says, you know, at the time I was responsible for distribution centers, millions and millions of worth of inventory. And he said, are you responsible for all that inventory? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, could you get fired when you go back to work on Monday? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, if you own your own business of buying and selling, you'll never get fired. And I thought that was pretty cool.
A lot of that sounded pretty attractive at that point.
Yep. So I actually went back that Monday and gave my 2 weeks notice and went to work for him and as a real estate agent. And I only sold 2 investors. I did a lot of the HUD and VA repos in '86.
Okay.
And I saw all these guys making these money flipping these houses, so I started doing it myself.
What skills did the corporate world, or what did you learn in the corporate world that you brought that was very useful to the house buying business?
That I got up at the same time as the corporate world, and I went to work every single day. You know, I had to put in my 40 to 60 hours a week, just like the corporate world, because that's what I was used to.
Okay.
And it wasn't like, oh, wow, this is pretty cool. I can sleep in. You know, you don't sleep in. You have to get up and go pound the payments, and that's exactly what I did every day. And I ran it just like I would a business.
Okay.
As I worked for the business.
How important was it to be shown by somebody that was already doing it?
It was very important. I mean, he told me exactly how to do it, what to do, how to comp them, how to figure out prices, you know, to fix them. It was a pretty good, he called it his boot camp.
His boot camp. Oh, that's probably maybe the first use of that word, actually.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah, that was his deal, and he was very adamant. If I was late, it was over. So I had to be there, and I actually had to watch him eat his breakfast. I had to watch him get ready practically and say, hey, let's get in the car and let's go. I followed every step and listened to all of his phone conversations and how he did it and how he worked with his investors and how he bought his. And
did he ever end up teaching other people?
No, he did not.
He did not. So
in his own office, he would pick a few people that wanted to learn what he did, and he would do it that way. No really formal training. I mean, there was no books and manuals. And
okay.
Just told me by his voice.
Why do you think he let you into his world?
Well, because I was a new real estate agent, and he wanted me to be successful so I could create commissions for him.
Yeah, but he's probably, there must have been 100 other people that had the opportunity, and he didn't see what he saw in you, I would bet.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
okay.
He liked the discipline background that I had.
Yeah, maybe hungry too. That's probably, you know, there's always people that ask, I'm sure you get asked a lot of times, please show me what you do.
And I get asked all the time.
I'm sure you've chosen a few along the way to do that.
A few, but they don't understand. It's not like I have a lot of people call me up and say, hey, let's have lunch and tell me what you do. I don't think I'll be able to tell you what I do over lunch.
Yeah. No. So, over the years, Bill, how many houses have you bought and sold?
Well, there's two answers to that. The bragging answer is I've closed 720 transactions or more.
Okay.
But the real number means that I've bought and sold 360 houses.
Okay. That's a lot of houses. And you've done it quite consistently. What percentage of those buys had you talking with the owners directly, would you say?
Well, me personally, probably not very much. But in the 90s... In the late 80s, I did a lot of, I had some people working for me that went and knocked on the notice of default and trustee sale.
Okay. Well, I asked the question because you really have, to me, an unusual model that has worked for you, and that's that you have a favorite way of buying, and it really is dealing with the inventory in the MLS.
Yes. I would say where I actually talk to the owners, I'd say it's probably under 10%.
And it's an expensive way to do it, too, because you always have to attract them to call you, and that's either mailers or signs or something.
Yeah, actually, I never used mailers, and I never used signs.
Okay. So you
never did that.
All right. So kind of give us a little bit of your methodology. If you just landed in Riverside for the first time knowing what you know, how would you spend your first month?
Going into Riverside as a brand new investor and never done it before?
No, you know what you're doing. So you fly into Riverside, but you know everything you know.
All right. Well, I would call my agent that I've worked with in the past or look for a new one and train them.
Okay.
And tell them and show them what I've done, what I've accomplished, and that I'm a serious investor. I remember in about 90 or 91, I started doing what I do full-time pretty much now, and that is buying almost 100% out of the MLS. I walked into a real estate office and told them I was a real estate investor, and the manager of the office said, well, do you know how many people come in here and say they're real estate investors? And I said, no, I really am. And so that didn't really go over too well with them, so I decided, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go take a picture of every house I've bought and sold. I'm going to put a portfolio together, and now I'm going to go to another office and tell them that I'm a real estate investor. And then I had something to show them, and then I asked them if I could give a talk at their sales meeting to let them know why it's good for a real estate agent to work with a professional real estate investor.
Mm-hmm.
So I give my talk for, 15 to 20 minutes and ask them who's interested. And, a few people raise their hand, and then I do a follow-up meeting. And I keep doing meetings and narrow it down to maybe one or two agents that I think that are really motivated to do, work with a real estate investor. And then I train them exactly how I buy houses.
Now, you said one or two agents. Is that in a city or an office?
In an office.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you go replicate it and talk to other offices?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And in my presentation, I keep my word with what I say, so anybody that calls me on the house first is the one that represents me. Because if you have a lot of agents in the same city, then you're going to get multiple calls on the same house. So they have to know. It's you got a little touchy there who you work with.
Okay.
So that'd be the first person that calls you.
Do you try to get relationships with the people that control, you know, kind of the most obvious sources of inventory, like repetitive REOs or the probate people, that type of thing?
I do not.
Okay.
I haven't gone to them directly, but over the years, I've met some of them.
And you've bought your share of properties that they had listed, probably.
Yes, and so they would recognize my name, and that's how, in a little bit, I can maybe talk about how I receive a phone call from my agent and the procedures that we go through.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and do that.
Okay. Well, I can give you, it's a Monday morning, and let's talk about a real estate agent, an investor that's out of the area of where I do my business, which is Riverside. And the phone call would go something like this to the investor. The agent calls them and said, hey, we had 20 new listings over the weekend, and there was 15 short sales, looks like 3 REOs and 2 standard sales. And the investor would say, a new one or somebody out of the area, well, did any of them look any good? I don't know. I haven't gone to see them yet, but let's go look at them this afternoon. So then they go out and they get their Thomas Guide out and they go look at some houses and then they try to figure out the comps. And by the end of the day, they might have looked at a bunch of the houses and narrowed it down to 1 or 2. And here's my phone call from my agent.
I was going to say, this is not what you do, I don't think.
No. this is what I'm competing against. And that's why people always say, how are you able to buy them?
Okay.
And that's what I'm competing against.
Okay.
And so here's my phone call. Hey, Bill, there's 20 new listings. One looks good. It's on Gardena Street. My first response is, who has it listed?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Joe over at ABC Real Estate. Okay, didn't we buy so-and-so from him? Yeah, okay, I'll give him a call. And I says, well, it's on Gardena Street. Is it on the north or south side? It's on the south side. Is it east or west of Palm? It's west of Palm. Oh, it backs up to the railroad tracks. Didn't I do one across the street from there? Yeah, last year. It's a 3-2. It's at 180.
Oh, I've owned it before.
I own the one across the street. I know the floor plan. There's a 3-2 on Emerson at 240. Standard sale in escrow. There's one on Cover at 180. Have you seen the house yet? No, actually, I'm standing in it right now. Oh, okay. What's it need? It needs 2 bathrooms, kitchen countertops, paint, water heater's gone. Okay, make an offer at 173. All right, I'll do it. That's it. So we looked at one house. I haven't seen it at this moment. And that offer's in probably within a few hours of being listed.
Okay.
So that's how you have to be fast. And because I've done it for so long, I know a lot of the streets. I know the floor plans. And that's why I'm able to beat a lot of people to the punch.
Well, there's a lot of lessons in what you just said. So first of all, it sounds like you've kind of instructed your agent to not talk to you about going out for seeing 20 properties, but to see only the one, and you don't have to see it. He does.
Right.
Okay. That's a big time saver.
Well, here's the real trick. The trick is the 20 listings that came up.
Yes.
Because the agent's been working with investors for 25 years. He looks down those streets, and he sees Gardena, and he sees the price next to it. He knows that that is a deal. He doesn't even have to open the file on the other 19. Because he knows the streets and knows that their value's not there. That's dealing with somebody that really knows what they're doing.
The majority of the agents would be skeptical that there's wholesale deals out there, not only literally every week or every other day, but even once in a lifetime, because I'm sure you've heard the comment, well, if the property would sell at that, I would buy it myself. So do you find agents that are in the business usually are really unaware that deals happen on a regular basis, and they're just unwilling to go through the work that it takes?
Well, you know, that's that part of being disciplined and doing it every day. I mean, I've just recently started training a new agent in January this year. In the first 2 months, he says, there's nothing here. I've written so many offers. He's looking at a whole lot more houses than my other agent because he really doesn't know what's a deal or not a deal, and he's having to figure it out and drive around. And
mm-hmm.
But all that discipline, all that work he's done, he has sold me 4 now since April.
Okay.
So now it's like, oh, you really can find deals in the MLS because that's the only way we are doing it. I've bought out of the MLS when the market's going up really high, when everybody says there's no way you can find a deal.
That,
back in 04 and 05.
Yeah, now, when you said that to me back then, that was very surprising to me because I would have bet against that. So you definitely surprised me and taught me something. So how different is it in a market where almost any owner-occupant is going to be your competitor. I mean, in that kind of market, there wasn't anything or any condition that wouldn't be bought, if possible, by an owner-occupant. So,
well, and that, again, what happened, and when the market was going up so fast, there was, because you're looking at it every single day, there's deals that just happen because you're in the game.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when that, you know, when they're going up 2 or 3% a month, you would, everybody was an investor. You didn't have to be so smart at it. And a lot of the agents that were even, a lot of people that even listed in the houses, they couldn't even keep up with it. So you'd see a house that come on the market that was like priced 20,000 low because he was using comps from 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, you already had 20,000 in it before he even made your offer. And then by the time you got in and fixed it up, you had another 20,000. So you could almost buy at market value or a little bit less, and you were making money at it, and that's why everybody was doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't, again, I didn't feel like I was really, I never really worried about competition because, I mean, even like with yourself and I don't know, maybe we have, but I don't even know if we've ever crossed paths on the same house because there's enough of them out there.
Yeah, there is enough of them out there. How important is name familiarity? In other words, Bill Shipp has made an offer, and they've got 10 other offers.
It's very important if they know you, if they've done a deal with you before, and you can, you know, show your proof of funds and, you know, that, hey, I've heard of this guy before, and he's got a reputation that he doesn't back out. I think in all the years I've done the business, I've maybe backed out of one offer. And they know that if it's, if they recognize my name and they've heard about me, they know that it's going to happen if my name's on that contract. So that's very important.
Okay. What kind of a deposit do you generally put up for something?
$5,000.
Okay. No matter what the price?
No matter what the price.
Okay.
Yeah. And I just on Monday, I just lost an offer with a guy here in Riverside put an offer. His deposit was 100% of the purchase price in a cashier's check.
You know where
his
learned?
His offer looks stronger than mine.
I know where he learned that. Yay.
Yeah.
That is a pretty strong offer. Pretty. Hopefully he'll refi it with the Norse Group.
Yeah. Yeah, that was like, wow, I lost it to that. And he offered $10,000 more than I did.
Oh, so. Well, I don't know if it's going to still work, but yeah, that is a powerful deposit.
Yeah.
How long do you normally close? What's the time frame for closing?
10 days.
10 days, okay.
Yeah, it's usually I usually put in there 10 days or seller's preference. I've actually lost offers by saying 10 days instead of 15.
You've lost them because it's too quick?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the rationale behind that?
The bank just didn't want to do it that fast.
Oh, okay.
And sometimes I've said 10 days and they said, no, you got to do it in 4 because it might be the 26th of the month and they got their bonus based upon they got to close it by the 30th. So I just pretty much let the seller decide that.
Okay. Multiple offers. So you make an offer and you get told, oh, there's 30 offers. How do you handle that?
Well, they come back and say, you do your highest and best.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I do.
Okay.
Just my highest and best. And if I get it, I don't. Because that's what's nice. I can be sitting out here by my pool when I wake up in the morning in this business and, well, I wonder if I'll make any money today. And then somebody calls you up and says, hey, we got a good house. And so...
Well, that sounds like hard work there, Bill.
Yeah, well, they tell you, you know, they tell you the spreads and how much it's going to cost to fix it. And they say it's your highest and best. And, you know, like, again, you woke up in the morning and you didn't plan on making $30,000. And then you say, well, my highest and best, my crews aren't very busy right now. Yeah, let's make 20. All right, raise the price 10. You know, mm-hmm. So it's a pretty cool business. Versus, you know, some investors are pretty strict. Oh, well, I don't do anything unless it's 62% of the value and the after this and after that and square foot price. And I've never looked at percentages. I've never looked at square foot. I don't look at any of that stuff. It's just hey, how much am I going to make and do I want to make that much today or not? And that's how much you raise your offer.
Okay. Now, we've really failed to mention that you don't even live in California most of the time.
No, I live in Park City.
Okay. Yeah. I think people would scratch their heads and go, okay, one of the biggest investors in Riverside, California lives in Utah. So you intentionally set up a business model that doesn't really need you anymore on a full-time basis to find deals.
No.
Do you know anybody that's done that?
No.
I don't really either.
Well, that's why I keep it to one city. You know, I can really spread myself thin and go to multiple cities, but I wouldn't be able to do that from out of state because I don't know the cities like that. And too, it's a logistic nightmare for all your contractors. And I've had houses where I had to like 17 cities, houses in 17 cities at one time,
mm-hmm.
back in the, you know, earlier days. And then sometimes I'd have a house way over like 60 miles away from my base, and I'd like always ignored it. It was like that child that I just didn't want to see.
Right.
So I actually ignored it for so long. I said, you know what, I got to get rid of this thing. So I'd wholesale it or something, you know, because I didn't want to take my crew and have them drive 60 miles one way and listen to all that about how far it is and how much more money he needs because gas has gone up. I can see all my houses probably in about 30 minutes because they're that close to each other.
Now, do you do any of this in Utah?
No.
Okay. So what do they think you do? They just think you retired?
Yeah, probably. Just, unless I get some phone calls about why something's not closing because it didn't appraise, or then I get all upset because the lender wants copies of everything that I did.
Okay. Oh, as far as repairs?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, what price range are you typically buying in?
Under 200.
Okay, so your buyer is very often an FHA buyer.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's funny, I would have to say that I wouldn't even say 10 or 15% of the last 2 years have been FHA. It's all conventional.
Okay. Well, that sure saved a lot of hassle.
Yeah.
Because the new appraisal rules and the 90-day wait, that did make FHA offers not very exciting to accept, that's for sure.
No, it sure didn't. In fact, when I came out of retirement again, because I've retired a few times, because when the market gets slow, I don't fight it. I just quit it. And then I get back into it when it makes sense. But my first offer was an FHA, and the 90-day rule was going on, which I didn't know about at the time because I just got back into it again. And, of course, the appraisal come in $15,000 low.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that thing, well, do I cancel it? Do I blow it out? And it was that same scenario. It was like, well, I made 10 instead of 20-something or whatever it is. Again, it's like, why fight it? You know, just sell it, move on. Don't fall in love with anything. Got to be a big boy. If it doesn't come in, then just go on to the next one.
Yeah. Now, when did you decide the market looked a little scary, and when did you get out?
I lucked out. I got out in 07, late 06, 07.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you say you get lucked out, that's... I
didn't luck.
I was going to say, it probably didn't play much of a part of it.
No, the reason why I got out of it is that I had multiple offers on every house, you know, way over list price, and they asked them for $10,000 in closing costs, 100% financing, and then I would see the loan doc sometime, and par would be 8%, and the interest rate was 10%, and the guy had a FICO score of 700. And it's like, this isn't right. And I just used to want to go tell the buyers, what are you thinking? And it was too crazy, so I just got out, and I sold everything, and that's when I moved to Park City full-time.
Do you buy and hold rentals?
No.
No.
Doesn't make sense for me at all.
Okay. Yeah. That's interesting, because most people think that's the... That's where they want to end up, is owning the pile of free and clear rentals.
Well, I look at it because of the way financing is now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a full-time person that flips houses and you're in and out of it and you are using leverage, I can show you how my returns will always be better than ever holding a rental. But a typical, if it's a passive investor, it's absolutely the right thing to do is to buy rentals.
Okay.
And a passive meaning that you have a job and you want to buy some rentals and you want to think about your retirement in the future, absolutely own rentals. And that's exactly what I did when I come out of the corporate world. I went crazy and bought a bunch of rentals. I think I had like 45 of them.
Oh, gee.
and then 1991 hit.
Uh-oh.
Or 90. And then I was at a $10,000 a month negative cash flow, and you know, they're fixing the houses when the people moved out, because when things get tough, people seem to move a lot more. And so I was always having vacancies. And
all right. Well, we're at the end of the time for our first segment. Bill, we're going to pick this subject up of different philosophies of how to end up getting wealthy and what you want. Bill Shipp, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you on our next segment.
All right. Thanks again, Bruce. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.